Good morning. Today's scripture passage comes from John chapter 1, verses 1 through 18, and you can find that on page 941 in your pew Bible. Hear the word of the Lord. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. All things were created through him, and apart from him, not one thing was created that has been created. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. That light shines in the darkness, and yet the darkness did not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify about the light, so that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but he came to testify about the light. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was created through him, and yet the world did not recognize him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, he gave them the right to be children of God, for those who believe in his name, who were born not of natural descent or of the will of the flesh or of the will of man, but of God. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We observed his glory, the glory as the one and only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified concerning him and exclaimed, "This was the one of whom I said, 'The one coming after me ranks ahead of me, because he existed before me.' Indeed, we have all received grace upon grace from his fullness. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The one and only Son, who is himself God and is at the Father's side, he has revealed him." This is God's holy and inspired word. Thanks be to God.
All right, good morning. Keep your Bibles open to John chapter 1 or your phones or whatever you're using to read the scriptures. And I had Jenny read the whole passage. I wanted us to see this whole passage. What a beautiful passage. We've been working through it slowly. We're going to focus our attention on verses 14 through 18. I want to start by asking you this question. Have you ever been in a long-distance relationship? Maybe you think back to college and your boyfriend or girlfriend's far away from you. Maybe it was when you got married and moved away and, you know, you were far from your parents. And those kinds of relationships can be kind of painful and sad. My sister and her husband, some of you know this, they lived in Hawaii for the past 3 or 4 years. And just recently, they decided to move back to the mainland, and they're actually going to be an hour and 45 minutes away in Lexington, Kentucky. We are so excited about that. We haven't seen them, of course, while they were in Hawaii too often. And so we're just excited to have them closer with us. And they've got a little one, and so, you know, cousins growing up together and all that fun stuff, right? You know, I think long-distance relationships only work if you have a prior established relationship, right? So it kind of keeps the relationships in stasis. But it's hard to develop if it's a long-distance relationship. Okay, they have Pastor Dick and his wife Susie. When they were dating, I think they were soon to be engaged. Asked them about this sometime. But Susie was overseas across the Atlantic Ocean, and Dick was here. And Dick would send these long, thoughtful, as you would imagine, letters, handwritten letters to Susie, which she thoroughly enjoyed, of course. And it took a couple weeks to get there. And so he's investing in that relationship. And, you know, of course, as technology develops over time, there's emails and, of course, the phone, and you can text people that are far from you. And then, lo and behold, there's the video call, Skype and Zoom, right? And that's helpful. It's good. It's better than nothing. But the Father's side, who is God, he has revealed him. You want to know God, look to Jesus. You want to grow in your knowledge of God, look to Jesus. Here's the meaning of Christ, and it's our main point as well. You can see it on your screen. Jesus makes the way, way, way up there God known to a humanity that is way, way, way down here. I'll say it again. Jesus makes the way, way, way up there God known to a humanity that is way, way, way down here. I want to show you three ways from this passage that Jesus does this, three ways that he supremely makes God known to us. Here's the first way. Jesus became flesh, as we're looking at that first part of verse 14, the first few words. We've already begun to kind of reflect on this. Let's continue. So this statement is one of the most significant, one of the most memorable sentences about Jesus ever penned. Its implications are limitless. We could stand up here, I could stand up here and preach sermon after sermon about just these four words. Thank God I'm not going to do that. But we could do that. We can unpack these four words. In fact, that's what the whole New Testament is about. It represents, these few words represent the heart and the climax of the gospel. Again, it's what Christmas is all about. The first few verses in this chapter, so verses 1 through 5, recall with me, they establish that Jesus is the divine, eternal Word. He's the creative agent of the Godhead. He brings light and life to this world. And so he is one with the Father. Well, here in these first four words, we see that Jesus is also one with humanity. Now think about this. In fact, we're going to think about this a lot. To think that Jesus humbled himself in this manner. I like Coswell's brief poetical line, "Lo, within the manger lies he who built the starry skies." Jesus is the divine Word, which means that he is the creator of all things. He is the sustainer of all things. So the laws of nature, the laws of gravity and thermodynamics, they are all governed by Jesus. The breath in our lungs, our beating hearts, the synapses that are firing in our brain, Jesus at any moment can withdraw his sustaining power and this world would fall apart. It's that Jesus. It's that Jesus who isn't greedily kind of clinging to his power and status according to Philippians chapter 2, but rather he emptied himself. He took the form of a servant. He was born in the likeness of man. It would be unthinkable to find the President of the United States tonight in your kitchen cooking you dinner, or the Pope ironing your clothes, or LeBron James raking your leaves. But isn't it far more amazing and unthinkable that the God of the universe has gone the distance to humble himself, to take on flesh, to be our servant, someone who is infinitely greater than any ruler or celebrity, that he would do this? The Word became flesh. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that he took on the full gamut of human existence. That's what the word sarx, it's a Greek word for flesh, that's what it means. What do you think about when you hear that word flesh? Flesh, right? Maybe tendons and muscles and tissues and hair follicles and sweat glands and bones and organs, or maybe some human activities like eating and sleeping and crying and laughing, being born and dying and suffering. Well, friends, Jesus embraced all of this, didn't he? He was born through a birth canal. He took on the spatial restrictions of a body. He experienced physical pain. Maybe he had acne, right? Who knows? We certainly lived through adolescence. He probably caught a cold. He took walks in his neighborhood. He definitely went to the bathroom. He cried as a boy, likely. We know he cried as a man. Jesus wept. He had a fleshy existence just like we do. He isn't some disembodied ghost out there, right? He didn't just kind of look like us. He actually added humanity to his prior divinity, such that now and forevermore, God is enfleshed in Jesus. Have you ever had this thought before? Jesus will never be unfleshed. He has forever taken humanity upon himself. So 2 million years from now, as we reside on this new earth existence with Jesus, he will be flesh just like us. Like you'll be able to touch Jesus. Incredible, right? You'll be able to touch God. Now, how do you think John's audience responded to this mind-blowing teaching about Jesus' incarnation? Well, if you were an educated Greek, this would be total foolishness to you, because they had these kind of Gnostic leanings. So they believed that the physical world was kind of downgraded and they would elevate the spiritual world, you know, the world of ideas and speculation and knowledge and the spirit and so forth. So the physical world was just kind of a shadow of the ideal world. So it wouldn't make sense for something divine to become flesh. Divine things don't come down. It's us that's got to kind of go up. So that's what they believed. So the incarnation was total foolishness, strangeness to them. Even today, consider the modern rationalist, okay? So how might this teaching of the incarnation land on them? Well, it wouldn't make sense to them. How can that which is eternal be bound up within time? How can God, if there really is such a thing as God, how can he ever be part of his creation? That wouldn't make sense to them. This teaching would also be hard for a postmodern mystic, an irrationalist, right? People today are so spiritual and mystical and open to the supernatural, which is great. That's a great start. But are they open to Jesus? You know, we're not saying, Christians aren't saying that the word, the divine, is in everyone, that you need to listen to the spark in yourself. That's not what we're saying. No, the word, the divine, became flesh, and he's in one person, right, named Jesus. And so if you want to be spiritual, it's not about getting in touch with yourself. It's actually about getting in touch with Jesus, coming in contact with Jesus, because the divine is not in you, the divine is in him. So the doctrine of Jesus' incarnation can be a challenge to some people outside the doors of the church, but for Christians, this has become so precious to us, right? This is one of the most beautiful doctrines that we Christians have. It's what C.S. Lewis called the grand miracle. So precious to us that God would love us this much, that he would come this close to us, that he would take on flesh. Amazing stuff, right? But there is a challenge embedded in this as well. So I want to think about this a little bit more. Sometimes we forget that the physical world is God's world, and therefore it is a good thing. Jesus' incarnation is one of the most powerful reminders that God affirms the physical world. For all of our sinfulness and fallenness, he doesn't want us to kind of discard humanity or set aside the physical world. Actually, he sent Jesus to reclaim the physical world, to redeem the physical world, to rebuild eventually the physical world. You know, I just heard that there's a certain church that has instituted a new way of doing church. So just recently, within the last couple of weeks, it's the first church that's now located in the metaverse. Okay, so it's a digital world. And so you can now create your own avatar, and then you stick this avatar in a digital theater, and there's a digital preacher that now preaches to your avatar. And this is what going to church is, right? If there ever was a digitalized Gnosticism, that's what this would be. And it's not good for us. It's not good for us. Hebrews chapter 10 says, the writer says to gather, and he doesn't mean digitally, he means physically, right? It's good for us to gather physically as a church. You know, as you think about Jesus, Jesus didn't become digital, he became flesh, right? He didn't take on an avatar. He didn't come down to us in 140 characters or less. He didn't create a Facebook profile and log in and interact with you through that. Jesus became flesh. In Jesus, we have the sacred entering the secular and turning it sacred. In Jesus, we have the divine spirit entering the fleshly realm and redeeming it. In Jesus, we don't just have a superior idea, we have a superior person. Christmas isn't a celebration of an idea, it's the celebration of a person, God incarnate. So if there ever was a stamp of approval for our physical humanity and even this physical world, it would be the incarnation of Jesus. Now, am I saying that we shouldn't interact with digital platforms? Well, it's a sin to like hold your phone and look at it. Some of you are doing that right now, right? No, I'm not saying that. Of course not. What I am saying is that we should interact with digital platforms in ways that are that will maintain and nurture our humanity. Listen, friends, one of the greatest gifts that you can give someone in this Christmas season is your presence. Your presence is a present. It's perhaps the best present that you can give in this season. As you're gathering with family, it's a great thing. Too many of us are so stuck behind these screens, whether it's a tablet or a phone or even a TV. And these things have the capacity to dehumanize us, if that's our main cup of tea. It has a sort of destabilizing force where we slowly detach ourselves from the physical world and we embrace this kind of strange and vague digital world. So let me just warn you and encourage you to consider that. Think about the Apostle Paul and his example to us, his affection for the first century churches, right? You read his letters, that's all we kind of have, and we have to kind of piece together his life and his priorities from these letters, but you almost get the sense that he hated writing those letters. He would have much more preferred being in person with those churches, right? In fact, he even says that. How many times did he say, I long to be with you? I long to be with you, Philippian church. I long to be with you, even Corinthian church. I long to hug your neck and ask you questions and laugh with you and cry with you and share experiences with you. Friends, these are countercultural activities in our digital world. These are rehumanizing activities. Jesus didn't only live and die to save our souls, he lived and died to save our bodies. Sometimes we forget that, right? At the end of time, when the new earth appears, we're going to have resurrection bodies, like flesh and blood bodies. So something for you to think about in this Christmas season. Put down your phones. Put down your tablets. Go hang out with some people. Create space to be with them. Take some walks. Here's an unusual application. Read some Wendell Berry. Let him inspire you a little bit. Embrace the physical life. Because Jesus did, because Jesus was physical. So that's the first way to make Jesus makes God known. Let's talk about the second way. Jesus tabernacles with us as we're looking at the rest of verse 14 and 15. And don't worry, we're going to pick up a little speed here. We just spent, 15 minutes on four words. All right, so let's look at the rest of verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We observed his glory, the glory as the one and only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. The Word, Jesus, not only took on flesh, he dwelt among us. He didn't just like hide in a cave for 33 years and then go to the cross, okay? Because of all the annoying people out there. He dwelt with us. The Greek word is it kind of conveys the sense that he set up a tent among us, or literally, he tabernacled with us. What does this call to mind? It kind of opens up that window of the Old Testament, right? This entire prologue, really, from verse 1 through 18, has its roots in the Old Testament. So verses 1 through 5, we talked about creation, and we saw its roots in Genesis chapter 1. Verses 6 through 13, we talked about light, and we saw some of those roots in the book of Isaiah. And here, verses 14 through 18, we see this emphasis on the tabernacle, and it has its roots in the book of Exodus, in particular, chapters 33 and 34. So John is well-schooled in the Bible of his day, which, of course, was the Old Testament. And here he sees how the tabernacle foreshadows and prefigures and points forward to Jesus. How does that happen? Well, let me just kind of zoom in on a particular scene in Exodus chapter 33. If you want to turn there, you can, but we can just talk through it a little bit. So after God rescues his people Israel, he brings them to his mountain, Mount Sinai. He gives them his law and covenant, and then he gives them all of these instructions about how to construct the tabernacle, which is kind of a tent of meeting where God comes down to meet his people. And before it's constructed, Moses actually sets up this tent of meeting where he'd meet with God, and God would come down in this pillar and cloud. And there's this great scene where all of the people, as Moses is meeting with God, all of the people would stand at the entrance of their own tents, and they would bow down and worship because God's glorious presence was upon them. This is how God would meet with Israel back in the Old Testament. So what is John saying? He's saying, just like that, the divine word has now come to dwell with us. He is setting up camp with us. And the words dwell and tent are kind of cognates of a Hebrew word, Shekinah. Have you heard that before? Shekinah. What does it mean? Glory. Glory. The Shekinah glory. Maybe you've heard that phrase before, the Shekinah glory. It's the effusive, radiant, revealed glory of God. Now, it's kind of hard to define the glory of God. In fact, a couple weeks ago when we were looking at Psalm 8, I gave you a definition. Let me give it to you again. This is how I define it, and you might define it differently. The glory of God is the public expression and appreciation of who God is. Okay, it's the public expression, so it's kind of radiating outwards. It's almost something you could see, and the appreciation, so the people of God are appreciating. What are they appreciating? Who God is, his character. So friends, this is what Israel felt as this pillar of cloud would kind of descend upon this tent, the shining glory, the Shekinah glory would be there. And this Shekinah glory is what John claims he and others experienced when Jesus came to tabernacle with us. So we see in verse 14. Look at verse 14 again. It says, we observed his glory. And so the entire ministry of Jesus was really a tabernacling with us, right? Where over and over and over and over again, what we see in him is glory, glory. Like what? Let me give you some examples. I want you to imagine yourself sitting on a boat, and there's a huge storm, and you can tell this boat might just kind of tip over here at any moment, but you've got Jesus in the boat. And you wake him up, and he stands up, and with just a few words, the storm ceases. That's glory. You're seeing glory right there. Imagine you were in the crowd listening to Jesus teach powerfully. Maybe his sermon kind of went through the day. Maybe it went for a couple days, but his teaching is so compelling and so riveting. You're there, you're sitting there, and you're feasting upon his words, but then you're starting to find yourself hungry physically. And then suddenly food starts to appear out of nowhere. And not only do you get some food, but like everybody around you gets food. And then you kind of look outwards and thousands of people are getting food that has appeared out of nowhere. That's glory. That's the glory of God manifested in Jesus. Imagine you had the privilege of climbing a small mountain with Jesus and just a couple of your buddies. And then suddenly you see Moses and Elijah, and you don't even know how you know it's Moses and Elijah, but you do. And then all of a sudden you see your rabbi physically kind of transfigure before your eyes, as if his flesh had masked the fullness of his being. And you recognize, at least in those few moments, that this is not just a man. This is God. Friends, these are all moments of Shekinah glory, where Jesus tabernacles and he kind of pulls back the curtain and he shows us who he really is. This wasn't just a fireworks show in the next town where you can kind of hear a little bit of, you know, the rumblings and the booms. This show came to our town. We can see his glory. In fact, according to verse 15, the Jesus show is way, way better than the John the Baptist show. You see verse 15? What does it say? John testified concerning him and exclaimed, this was the one of whom I said, the one coming after me ranks ahead of me because he existed before me. As amazing and compelling and powerful as John the Baptist's ministry and teaching and all that was, his life, his ministry was in service of something greater, right? Because even though Jesus was born after John the Baptist, he actually existed before John the Baptist, right? And therefore, he ranks higher than John the Baptist. If you're first, you're better. If you're second, you're what? You're the first loser, right? You always want to be the first in line. You know, you're in the lunch line, you want to be the first in line. The best people get on the plane first, right? First class, that's why they're called that. The rest of us load when zone 9 is called. Got to find some space for the luggage. Well, friends, Jesus brings a better, clearer revelation of God than even John the Baptist. And all of the prophets that he represents, all of the Old Testament prophets, like all those guys are like the warm-up bands for Jesus, right? He's the main deal. Listen to the opening lines of the book of Hebrews. Long ago, God spoke to our ancestors by the prophets at different times and in different ways. So that's a reference to the Old Testament, Old Covenant prophets. In these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. God has appointed him heir of all things and made the universe through him. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact expression of his nature. It's almost like the author of the book of Hebrews was reflecting on John chapter 1 when he wrote those words. Friends, clearly Jesus is the greatest revelation of God, right? Nothing higher. If you want to know who God is, the best way is to look at Jesus. Why? Well, he is the God of the Old Testament. He's the one who tabernacles with us, and he bears the Shekinah glory of God. And here's the cool thing. We can actually see it with spiritual eyes, right? So friends, at some point, whether it's this morning or another moments later this week, we've got to stop and ponder this, don't we? This stuff is too good to just kind of pass by like a house with bad Christmas lights. You don't stop, you don't linger. But friends, these truths, I mean, it would behoove you and me to slow down and ponder this, right? The greatness of these truths assaults the mind and staggers the imagination and inspires us to wonder and worship. Christmas cannot be relegated to just a historical marker or the birth date of an important religious figure or an enjoyable time when family gathers. Christmas can only be properly understood through the experience of wonder and worship. Let me just invite you to do that this Christmas season. Slow down, take a moment here with us as we gather, or even by yourself or with your family. Who is he in yonder stall at whose feet the shepherds fall? Tis the Lord, O wondrous story. Tis the Lord, the King of glory. At his feet we humbly fall. Crown him, Lord of all. Amen. So we see Jesus becoming flesh, tabernacling with us, and then the final turn of the diamonds. Here's our third point as we're looking at verses 16 and 17. Jesus brings new grace, new grace. Let's read these verses together. Indeed, we have all received grace upon grace from his fullness, for the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. I love these verses. This is another Chipotle burrito section for me. You know, so much yummy goodness packed into just a small little space, these two verses. And then that phrase, grace and truth, has its roots, shocker, in Exodus as well. Exodus 34, in fact, where the first time we see this statement, which is repeated and echoed all the way through the Old Testament, God's steadfast love and faithfulness. Steadfast love and faithfulness. So what John's saying is, listen, what you had in the Old Testament and in the Old Covenant, you have now with Jesus. And do you see that phrase in verse 16? We have all received grace upon grace from his fullness. Now that word upon in the Greek, I think a better translation is instead of. So John is saying you've received grace instead of or in place of another grace. What does that mean? I think the next verse clarifies for us. Look at verse 17. For the law was given through Moses, that's one grace. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Here's another grace. So God shows us, he shows us so much grace in the Old Testament, but now we've got a superior grace. Now, it's not like Moses or the law or the Old Covenant was bad. It absolutely communicated God's grace and truth, but it wasn't enough. Jesus is the final, decisive, definitive revelation of God's grace and truth. Moses was a prophet who spoke God's word. Jesus is the word. Moses gave the law, and Jesus fulfills it. Moses brought forth the tabernacle. Jesus is the tabernacle. Moses hid his face from God. Jesus reveals the face of God. Listen, we have a superior grace in Jesus. You know, it's like the Old Testament's a pair of glasses that is just like one notch off your prescription. Have you had that before? It's a tad blurry, but you can kind of make do, right? But then someone hands you the right glasses with the right prescription, and you're like, whoa, I could see everything clearly. That's Jesus. He makes God crystal clear. Let me give you an example. Let's consider the idea that's in this verse, grace. Okay, so what's grace? Grace, the basic idea, is an undeserved gift. What do we deserve? We deserve the wrath of God and the judgment of God due to the sin that we have contributed, right, to society, the sin that's in us. We are warped by sin, and so we deserve judgment, and so we need God to intervene. We need God to bring his grace, and thankfully he does. How do we know God is a God of grace? Well, let's first look at creation. He made creation. He reveals himself in creation, and it doesn't matter how bad life gets, right? He's going to pour out his grace. So like the sun is still up there shining. The rain is still pouring down its goodness right on the earth. Whether you're a good person or a bad person, that's true. So creation is full of grace, right? All right, well, let's kind of adjust our prescription a little bit. Let's look at the Old Testament. And the Old Testament makes God's grace even more clear. So in the Old Testament, what do we see? We see this nation Israel that God chooses. And he doesn't choose them because they're awesome and faithful and they have a sparkling spiritual resume. He chooses them because he puts his love on them. And for most of their existence, they were pretty unfaithful and they were a mess, right?
But God still kept pouring his grace on them. And even when he was judging Israel, he would set aside these promises to them. And he would say, listen, a Messiah is coming and the light will come and dawn on you. I will save you and deliver you. You know, sometimes we think of the Old Testament as depicting judgment and wrath and a God of wrath and people are dying and, you know, there's no mercy in it, right? Sometimes we feel that way about the Old Testament and then get to the New Testament and it's like, oh, Jesus and butterflies and good things, right? And flowers and... Well, friends, that's not true. The Old Testament is oozing with grace. I mean, it's everywhere you will find grace. It's just not the final expression of grace. So we got to put on those last glasses, the Jesus glasses. We got to update our prescription, right? And we see that through the lens of the New Testament. And this is where we see the highest depiction of grace. That the way, 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 way up there, God would come way, way down here to us, take on our flesh, and he would die on the cross. He would take on our judgment on himself. I mean, is there any higher expression of grace than that? While we were yet sinners, while we were yet enemies of God, he died for us. You know, we might look at creation in the Old Testament and think, yeah, people didn't really deserve that sort of grace that they received. But friends, the cross, I mean, think about the cross. The cross is immensely costly, isn't it? It took the blood of God's begotten Son. Is there any higher payment than that? Has there been any higher injustice in human history than what we see on the cross? No. Right there, the cross of Jesus is the Mount Everest of grace. There's nothing else you can be thinking about that would demonstrate and display and magnify God's grace to you other than the cross of Jesus, where justice and injustice all come together and God's love is on full display. And friends, this is just one example. We can think of other ways that Jesus exemplifies the character of God. So therefore, my friends, no one shows us God like Jesus. No one. If you got Jesus, you have the highest, clearest revelation of God. You want to know God, something about him, then you need to contemplate Jesus. This is what Christmas is all about, isn't it? What is Christmas in three words? God with us. God, gotta load that thing up, right? God, the God of the universe, the creator and sustainer of all things, the giver of life ex nihilo, that God is somehow with us. This is the beauty of Jesus. He brings together the transcendence and the immanence of God, doesn't he? He's above us. He is holy. He's king in a way that we will never be. And yet, he is somehow with us. And isn't this precisely what each of us needs? Some of us here this morning are hurting, are suffering in this season. Many of us here at Faith Church are grieving. Life is more a burden, perhaps, than a joy right now for you. And when the storms of life hit us, what do you want? What do we want? We want firm ground under our feet, right? You don't just want best friend Jesus. You want a transcendent, creative agent of the Godhead, the giver of life ex nihilo, Jesus. You want powerful Jesus to show up in the storms of your life, right? The guy that with a few words can silence the storms of your life. That's the Jesus that you want. But we also don't just want an aloof, distant Jesus, do we? We want the one who will be with us in the storm. The one who identifies with us, who sympathizes with our weaknesses, who puts an arm around us, who has promised his presence with us regardless of what we go through. That's also who we want. And friends, in Jesus, we have both. There's no other religion, there's no other philosophy, there's no spiritual guru can offer this. It's only Christianity that puts forth a holy God who stoops so low to get us out of this present darkness. And that's why we sing. That's why we sang this earlier, this service, right? Joy to the world. Joy, not just for me and you and the Christian, joy to the world. The Lord, the Holy One of Israel, the root of David, right? He has come. He has come. Let earth receive her king. It's not just a Christmas anthem. It ought to be a daily chorus because it feeds our faith and it stokes the flames of our hope. So in this Christmas season, may your hearts and minds be so riveted by the meaning of Jesus as we have seen here in John chapter 1, this incomparable introduction which has carried us to the furthest reaches of eternity past and the ultimate depths of the Godhead, right? And then says to us, this big God is with you in Jesus. Amen. Let's take a moment of silence now to contemplate this passage and prepare ourselves for the Lord's Supper.